This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now, tonight we're going to talk to one of our most celebrated actors. Gabriel Byrne has won a Golden Globe. He started in The Reardons and Bracken on RTE and has gone on to work with some of the greatest actors and work with also some of the great directors. John Boorman in Excalibur, Defence of the Realm, Miller's Crossing, Usual Suspects, and the Golden Globe he won for In Treatment, which was a huge success for HBO, and it's a pleasure to welcome him to Stand. He's written a memoir. It's a superb piece of work. Extraordinary, really. Gabriel, it's a superb piece of work. How difficult was it to go back to your past? The title, Walking with Ghosts, is very apt. How difficult was it for you to decide to go back to the painful past and to evoke times when you were essentially a street kid?
I think all of us live to a great extent in the past, and we also live in the future. But what's difficult to do is to live absolutely in the present. I find that the great challenge. To go back into the past and see how the events, sometimes events that you didn't recognize or identify at the time, how those events, cultural, social, religious, familial, how they informed the person that you become in later life is something that always has interested me. And it wasn't difficult to look back. What I wanted to try to do was evoke honestly as I could, the world that I was brought up in, so that it could contrast with the world that I live in today, and to speak for that generation through my own experience. A memoir, as you know, Eamon, it's a very different creature from a novel, because in a novel, it seems to me that you can hide behind characters. Yes. And give him a bit of that and give him to say that and so forth. And you're pulling the strings to a certain extent. An essay distances you from the subject matter. But when you describe events through the filter of your own emotions, you're confronted on every page with, is this the truth? Is this honest? Do I put this down? Do I say it? And I always thought that there's no point in writing something like this unless you are going to be honest. And I believe that by being honest, you have more of a chance of connecting emotionally with people than if you fudge and you become kind of... You want to make it something that it isn't, because the memory itself is a very unreliable narrator. It's a very fractured thing. Yes. And sometimes the line between imagination and memory is very, very thin. But as much as I could possibly do it, I started off with the idea that we remember things in images to a great extent. And so images lead to emotion. And I thought that if I can just get some of these images down, images and imagination and memory are connected. So I started from that point of view to create a kind of a sensual, I don't mean sexual, but a sensual experience of what it was like to be alive at that time.
Yes, and I wonder what you may have not so much discovered about yourself, Gabriel, but how much pain or remorse struck you when you looked at some of the really bad moments in your life, particularly in the seminary where you went when I think you were 12. You evoked that frighteningly, really, the horror of it, and yet the sort of ostensible normality of it. Was it really, did it hit you again when you started to write this?
No, the simple answer is no, it didn't. What I wanted to do was to try to explore the world from a child's point of view. And one of the gifts and also one of the obstacles of being a child is that you don't really know what's going on. You don't have a clear picture of authority, for example. Authority was there to tell you what to do. I found authority very difficult to deal with when I was at school, because I felt, looking back in this reminiscence or recollection, that the authority that I was subjected to wasn't about the empowerment of my identity as a person. It was about the deconstruction of my identity as a person.
Yeah.
So I was told, this is what you have to believe. This is what you have to do. Whether you understand it or not, you have to do it. And you don't ask whether it's right or wrong. You just do it. And that authority was meted out with a certain degree of cruelty. And it was wrapped in fear and shame. So when I was growing up, the great places of escape for me were the church, which seemed to me to be like a fairy tale place where your imagination could take wing and you were given very simple answers to very complex questions. The other place was the cinema, where you could go and again, you could be transported into this place where, you know, reality didn't enter. And the other place was in sports, listening to football matches on the radio, but also playing imaginary cup finals and yes. World Cups on the footpath.
Yes.
Like we dived on concrete. We played in snow. The urge to play the game, to imagine that you were yes. playing at Old Trafford or whatever, was so seductive that it took you way out of the realm of reality. And reality for me was always difficult, the isness of the situation. And I fled into the church, into the cinema, and into sports to get away from the grayness of reality. And so when I went to that seminary, I was presented with authority in the form of men of God. Now that's a double whammy, because it wasn't just a teacher telling you something to do or your parent. This was a man of God who was called by God. So everything that he had to say had to be right, had to be something that you just didn't question. What I tried to capture in that, which I remember very vividly, is the language of seduction. I've never actually seen that written down before, how a predator goes about seducing, an innocent.
Yes, and he takes you to his study and he gives you drink. Remarkably, and it's one of many, many striking images in this beautiful book, when you're okay and your life is together, you ring him. Eventually you get through and you challenge. Well, you don't challenge him. You just ask him if he remembers you. And I I thought that was a remarkable thing to do, a brave thing to do. And his response, as you describe it in the book, is kind of creepy. But it's striking and noteworthy that you don't hate him at that moment. You actually put a line in. The line is, you know, you feel he's an old man. Mm-hmm. And it's almost as if you feel sorry for him.
Yeah. I think I didn't realize at the time that what I was doing was in any way unusual or courageous or anything. I needed to know the answer. And it was in the realm of memory. Do you remember me?
Yes.
Because I've never forgotten you. But what the phone call taught me more than anything, which is a truism about life, I think, there are things that don't have a resolution, and we have to accept that they can't be resolved. People who lose somebody suddenly in an accident or something have to live with a lack of resolution. Fiction, plays, novels, films teach us that there's an obstacle. The obstacle is overcome, and there's a resolution at the end. And that's how that's why we are drawn to fiction. But reality is something different. It doesn't have to be an answer.
No, absolutely. The other striking figure, or one of many striking figures, is a girl, a young girl, when you are yourself young, called. You call her, she calls herself, in fact, the grease monkey. This is when, I think when you were setting out to be a plumber, but it's very much a street kid story. You are mates, you are pals. And you describe in the book something many of us would be able to identify with. You really, it wasn't sexual, the relationship, and yet the other guys on the street thought it should be or would be or was. And you went along with their idea. And they said, did you ride her? And you said, yes. They taunted her and you lost that person. And she's a recurring character in the book. You go back to her later in the book. This is a story, of course, against yourself. It's a very searing honesty, but it also underlines how hurt somebody can be when you betray them.
Yes, it's essentially about betrayal and how you betray people who's worth to you. You don't question and take for granted. And it's only when you betray them that you realize how deep and meaningful their presence in your life is. I betrayed her for a quick and easy acceptance into a group of guys who thought of her as a slag.
Yes.
And they were incredibly cruel when they described her. And in the way that young boys can be. And the idea was that by in the way that sex was presented at that time, you got something from her or you put something over on her. It wasn't anything shared. So you did it, you got it, and you put her in her place. Well, in order to win the acceptance of the crowd, I said that I had. But actually, we weren't sexually attracted to each other. We were friends, mates. And
you met her or encountered her on a few occasions subsequently, and she just blanked you.
Which she did, and I remember at the time feeling conflicted about that, saying, "Why is she so? What's her problem?" Well, of course, in the arrogance of youth, you don't understand how you can deeply hurt another person. And the point of the story is that a betrayal like that never actually leaves you. And how do you face up to it? To say, "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that," because we've all we all understand what betrayal is, and sometimes we betray ourselves as well as other people. But the song that we used to sing together in that rusty old car, which was a Marty Robbins song, yes, about the streets of Laredo, some people might remember it. But I was memory is a tripwire. You're walking along among Christmas trees in Brooklyn many, many, many years later, and that song came out from a little transistor that a guy was sitting beside, and I thought, oh my God, that's the song.
Yes.
And the point I wanted to make was that, again, with memory, the songs that mean so much to us when we're growing up and that impinge themselves on our consciousness will break your heart later on when, yes, you listen to them, because you don't really understand what the effect of that was on your inner self. So I grew up with the Beatles, and to be absolutely honest, Damon, I find it hard to listen to the Beatles now, because the influence of their music on me in that coming awake time,
yes,
was so profound that listening to it now, I see and hear my younger self not really understanding why I was singing those songs. But now when I think about a song like, I was just thinking about this the other day, because I sometimes use those songs to remind myself. If you think about a song like Help.
Yes.
I need somebody, yes, not just anybody.
Yes.
Help.
Yes.
When I was young and so much younger than today, I didn't need anybody's help in any way.
Yes.
But now those days are gone. I feel so insecure. Won't you please, please help me?
Yes.
What an amazing song that is. And so many of us are afraid to reach out for help. At 23 and 24, they were downloading that from somewhere in the ether and putting it into beautiful music. Now, when I heard that song of the streets of Laredo in Brooklyn, I understood with a swell of emotion in that moment that I could never listen to that song again, because that song was now about how I had betrayed her. And I'm not proud of the fact that I betrayed her, but we all commit greater and smaller betrayals throughout our lives, and sometimes we get away with them and sometimes we don't.
Yes, that's really why I wanted to ask you about what you discovered about yourself.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
I wrote a memoir myself 2 or 3 years ago, and I it made me sad in a way that you sad a bit guilty in the way that I had. I'd gone to England. I left my family, a small family, one brother, and mum and dad. And when I came to write about them recently, I felt that I'd been a bad son and that I'd gone to the big world. I'd lapped it up. And some part of me was gone, a very important part of me. And you've made much of the same journey in a way, away from Ireland, away from family. And I wonder if you felt that.
Yeah, it's a good observation, Eamon, because I think that I wonder where that sense of not being good enough comes from, of being guilty about who you were, even though if you really examine the evidence, you're only as aware as you can be aware.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think you set out to say, well, you know what, the parents can go sink or swim because I'm going to have a good life. It's inevitable that we pass out our parents.
Yes.
And we leave them behind in one form or another. And they do disappear out of our lives. The title of the book is called Walking with Ghosts.
Yes.
And in the end, I said in the conversation, the imaginary conversation with my mother, was I a good enough son?
Yes.
Did I close the door on you when you most needed me?
Yes.
Was I afraid that you would suck my soul out of me if I let you?
Yes.
I think that we as Irish people or as Catholics or whatever, because Catholicism and the culture are kind of mixed up together. But why do we give ourselves such a hard time through guilt about the kind of people that we were? Because one of the things that I was able to do in this book was to listen to my father's voice and to listen to my mother's voice and to hear that they would have understood who I became. And they would have been happy that I became the person I became.
Yes.
And their world was a world that I'm sure, like yours, was their roles were prescribed for them. You went to work, you came home with the wage packet, you put it on the mantelpiece, you got a few quid for cigarettes and a drink, and you worked. And then you retired, and the mother took care of the house and fed everybody. And at the end, I thought to myself, was that enough for them? Was that life enough?
Yes.
Could they have been more than that? Would they have thrived in a different culture, in a different, with a different kind of impetus in their lives? And I remember once I was in Malibu, in Los Angeles, and somebody said to me, "Oh, you should go and see this guy. He's an amazing healer." They're always saying that in LA. But anyway, this guy, I went down to see this guy, candles and incense and, a robe on him. And he said, "Okay, I want you to lie on the table and breathe and let everything go." And I lay and I relaxed. And then he started to work on my neck and my shoulders and my head. And I was absolutely shocked to realize that I was becoming emotional.
Yeah.
And I thought, why the hell am I becoming emotional?
Yeah.
Why is this? And I realized that this was an experience that my father or mother would never have been exposed to, ever, to be touched in a healing way by a stranger.
Yes.
So it was an example to me of the world that they didn't have. Okay, they had great things in one way, but I often wonder who would my mother have been if she'd lived somewhere else, or my father, and who indeed would I have been if I had not left at that time, and why did I go?
Yes.
In your case, I can understand that the greatest, the most fantastical dream that I had as a young kid growing up was not to play for Manchester United, to get to see a game at Old Trafford, never mind play for Manchester. Yes. Mind you, I played for United many, many times in the back garden.
Yes.
But it was the fulfillment of a fantasy to go to Manchester United for you, I'm sure. But for me, I never thought I would ever end up in Hollywood. I went into amateur drama because I didn't know what to be doing with myself at night, and I had to stay out of the pubs. So I didn't set out to say, well, this is what I'm going to be. But I did feel that guilt that you're talking about. But what I do now say to myself is, no more guilt.
Yes.
Because the one thing that's absolutely useless in life, that serves no function whatsoever, is guilt. Because it hands you a big whip to lacerate yourself with for no obvious result. What is it that keeps us doing that? Because we have this sense that we don't deserve it. You're getting above your station. You should have done this. You should have done that. And you're not supposed to be doing. Well, who are those voices?
Yeah, well, it's...
Because now when I... go ahead, Ian.
No,
sorry.
I was just going to say, Gabriel, that you know yourself, the begrudgers around this place. Who do you think? Who does he think he is?
Who does he think he is? Yeah.
It is a feature of a small place, isn't it?
It is.
And I was going to ask you about the kind of... You live in the United States now, and I just wonder if there's an incredible freedom there that you can... I mean, we're all watching the Trump show, of course, but you can still... the Americans seem to believe. They never say, who does he think he is? They think, go for it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a discernible difference between Ireland and America?
Yeah, that's a good question, Eamon. But I don't know that I believe in absolutism anymore.
Right.
I don't believe that everybody in Dublin is a begrudger. Though having said that, there's a fair amount of
I think
it
we
there,
have
as
a few
you know.
Mutual friends we could put on the
right.
list.
But right. Well, you haven't really lived till you've walked past two fellas in the doorway in Dublin, standing outside the pub having a smoke. To try to figure out what they're saying about you as you walk past. But I think...
it just seems
yes,
that,
is it?
That in Ireland, it's not like that now because of you and Bono and Geldof, all kinds of people who have gone on and done amazing things, amazing work. It's much more possible now than it used to be. The begrudgery thing is not... so bad, but it's around. Let me ask you, Gabriel, about addiction. And I don't want to dwell on that as if that's who you are. But the reason I want to ask you, you vividly describe in the book moments when you were drinking too much, it was destroying your life, and you conquered it. And many people don't. Can you trace it back to, say, the abuse, or is that just too simplistic?
I don't think there's a connection there. There may be, but I can't honestly say I connect one with the other. I do believe that certain people have a propensity to be addicted. They can be addicted to a fly crawling up a wall. I mean, if you have an addictive personality, and that has been very well documented in the world of psychology, there are people who have addictive personalities and people who don't. That addiction comes out, and it doesn't matter whether you're, whether you've had a wonderful childhood or not. There are people for whom the dopamine release in the brain is connected with the act of reward. So I'll have a cigarette. I'm on the phone. Oh, that was a bit stressful. I'll have a cigarette. Yeah. Oh, I'm meeting your man for a drink. I'll have a cigarette. That's addiction.
Yes.
And alcohol is an addiction too. I would say more of less an addiction than an allergy, an allergic reaction to alcohol. And I would say that the reason I drank was not just because I have an addictive personality, which I do have. I try to channel it now into positive addiction. Nothing too mad, but kind of keeping it positive. But I drank because reality was very difficult for me to deal with. reality is difficult. Getting through life on a daily basis for most people is tough.
Yeah.
And so I didn't want to be in that struggle. So most of the time, the isness of life, you know, give me this, that'll take me out of it. Because the peculiar thing about addiction or you know, say drinking, is that you wake up the next morning with a desperate hangover. Even that is a form of taking you out of reality.
Yes.
Because you have to deal with the hangover and you say, oh, Jesus. Where did I go? Like, what was I doing? Oh, God, no, not again.
There's a nice,
all that stuff.
A nice story in the book. I think you were coming to the end of your drinking days when you wake up beside a nice girl in, and she walks out the door. But that can happen too. The book is a writer who I have great respect for. He's a brilliant writer. Colin McCann has described Walking with Ghosts as a masterpiece, and I think it is a masterpiece. And I would have liked, I want to ask you about how brilliantly you've written, knowing how difficult it is to write. Are you encouraged to think there may be a Walking with Ghosts 2?
I don't think there's a Walking with Ghosts too, but what it has given me is a kind of confidence to say you can do this and you can write. And I'm working at the moment on, and I don't say too much because people are always working on things. And
yeah,
you know, Dublin was full of people with novels sticking out of their pockets. Yeah. You know, and But I think that there are themes that I can write about. And the book that I'm writing about now, somewhat into this novel, it's about some of the things that we've talked about. It's about what home is.
Yeah, and it, the prose in the book is beautiful. It's simple. There's not a bad line in it. And that is a very, very difficult thing to do. And I want to congratulate you and say to our audience that this is a book everyone should really buy. Now, that's a cliche, but it's a beautiful book. It's a simple read. It's an enjoyable read. And it's very, very funny in many, many places for all kinds of reasons. One of them being when your brother got you a job working in the kitchen at one of the hotels in town. And you got rid of the bride's cauliflower. But the finally, before you go, the living in the United States at the moment and watching the way the United States is, the polarization there politically, and you've been living there for a long time, is it changing, Gabriel, and is it troubling for you?
Well, that's a good question. I would say, bucking the trend of popular kind of conception, I don't believe that America is as divided as it's made out to be. If you take a survey of people, whether they're Democratic or Republican supporters, who are on the ground, I mean by, you know, working class, middle class people, they all want the same thing. They want Medicare. They want their kids to be educated. They want the minimum wage. They want to be not trapped by student debt. Those parties both know that, yet they will not deliver it to them. The real battle in America is going to be over the next 4 years, and it's not just going to be about the Democrats versus the Republicans. It's going to be for the consciousness of the Democratic Party itself, because the old guard like Schumer and Pelosi and Clinton and Obama and even Biden himself, they are what you might call the establishment corporate Democrats. And they've shut down Bernie Sanders and they're shutting down AOC because they regard them as radicals. Now, if they don't make an effort, a real effort, and I doubt that they will, to get back those 73 million votes that Trump took off them.
Yeah.
And those people were promised hope and change in 2008. And the reason they voted for Trump in 2016 wasn't because they were idiots. They voted for Trump because what had been promised them for 8 years was not delivered.
Yes.
And America was in a much worse position economically than it had been before. So you talk to an ordinary guy on the street and you say, I'm losing money every day. I'm working three jobs. When is this going to happen? So Trump rides in like Elmer Gantry and says, I can do it. Follow me.
Yeah.
And they all say, yeah, he'll do it because he's... Well, of course, he sold them a false bill of goods as well. But the idea that Biden is going to reverse everything in 4 years is nonsense.
No. Oh.
Because he can't do that. And he's going to find huge objections on the Senate and House floor to any kind of meaningful legislation. And the only thing he can really do is change some surface thing by executive order in the first 100 days. But I think that the economic system that prevails in America, which nobody ever talks about here, is a fundamentally unjust one. And it's the power of neoliberal economics, as espoused by Milton Friedman and, you know, the trickle-down effect. Money does not trickle down. It trickles into accounts in the Seychelles.
Yes.
It does not trickle down to people in Philadelphia. And the neoliberal view, economic view of the world, is essentially this: the enrichment of the few at the expense of the many. And that division that you're talking about in America is a false one.
Yes.
And it's exploited by these parties, aided and abetted by the media, both right and left. So that's my take on it. And I think that the avalanche of propaganda that masquerades as news, you hear people exchanging viewpoints with each other, and all they're really doing is exchanging propaganda from one side or the other.
Yes.
The big picture, the facts, never get a look in. The presidential election did not address one topic that meant anything to anybody on the ground. And if you talk about the battle for the soul of America and healing it, that means nothing to people.
No.
Just like the glass ceiling meant nothing to people and Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
Donald Trump despises working class people. Hillary Clinton despised them. And you have to say that there's a real possibility that the Democratic and Republican Party despise their working class and middle class voters. People have become enriched through the Democrats and the Republicans, but we have to listen to those people on the ground. We have to listen to OAC and the squad and those people, because what we think is the news is not the news. Six major corporations own all the information outlets in the state, and they have a political agenda, and they know how to present it, and they present it in the form of, like, why are people still talking about Donald Trump's hair, the toilet paper on his shoe? Is Melania imprisoned? Is Jared Kushner, has he no charisma? These are things that don't matter.
Yeah,
what really matters are the issues, the real issues that affect people's lives. And it's the same thing in Ireland. It's the same thing in Britain. You know, it's bumbling Boris and did Leo say this? And that's not what it's about. Information and politics are now so welded together that what matters is how charismatic or good looking or what kind of a bullshit quote you can give to the papers. That's what's going to get you elected.
Okay, Gabriel, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Reading the book was beautiful experience. It's superb. It's published by Picador. It's called Walking with Ghosts. It really is a very, very special book. So if you know someone or love someone, buy it for them for Christmas. We're grateful to Gabriel for joining us, to you for listening. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.